to the GCD Book Club Conversation. We're glad to have you with us today for the next conversation from Chapter 3 and Chapter 4 of Trevin Wax's book, This Is Our Time. My name is Jeremy Ripel. I'm the Executive Director of Gospel Center Discipleship, and glad to have you with us, as well as my co-host, Grayson Pope, who's our Managing Editor of our website. And we're glad to have you, Grayson. Good to hear from you today. How are you?
Good to be back, Jeremy. Doing good. How are you?
Great. Doing very well today. So it's been an exciting week for us over the last couple of weeks. I had an opportunity to talk with Trevin last week and to share that interview with him. And we'll have another conversation coming up here in the next few weeks with Trevin as well. So I want to encourage our readers and our supporters to send in any questions that you have for Trevin Wax about the book and about just what you're learning or grasping from This Is Our Time. That was a great conversation last week, and we're looking forward to discussing just a little bit Chapter 3 and Chapter 4 today. How about that, Grayson?
Yeah, that sounds good. Let's jump in.
Excellent. Let's do it today. So Chapter 3, talking about the North Pole and the pursuit of happiness. And Trevin lays out this idea that we've got kind of an internal compass with a goal or a trajectory at it. And we often find ourselves in a precarious situation in life because our compass is off. What do we do about that?
Yeah, well, Trevin said in your last conversation, this chapter is kind of the key to unlocking the rest of the book. It's what he views as the most important chapter here. And really, I think it's because it gets at some of those the most difficult myths in our culture to point out and to actually see what's going on there. Because it's kind of like that the fish swimming in water. If you tell the fish he's swimming in water, they're like, what water? You know what I mean? They're just surrounded by it. Yeah. They don't realize that they're actually swimming in it. And it's the same way with us when it comes to culture. Page 68, he has these really good quotes from James K.A. Smith that I thought really just kind of nailed this, the idea that he was introducing. James K.A. Smith writes, "Our culture often sells us faulty, fantastical maps of the good life that paint alluring pictures that draw us toward them. And all too often, we stake the expedition of our lives on them, setting sail toward them with every sheet hoisted. And we do so without even thinking about it because these maps work on our imagination." Hmm. And it's those maps that are really kind of below the surface working on us at the imagination and story level that Trevin kind of goes on to unpack a little bit of.
Yeah, and that's where we get off so easily. I think one of the things I really appreciated from this chapter was the sense of the kind of the way that Trevin laid out some of the maps that we have. That he describes it this way. He says, we might say that we have three maps, the search for status, for satisfaction, and for the self. And each of those are different ways of trying to reach ultimately what he says is transcendence in that way. So I think I've seen those maps play out in my own life where I want to be seen as a significant person, or I want to be really happy, or just like take care of me. And that usually... like the illustration of the journey to the North Pole, that usually ends me up in a shipwrecked state for a little while.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking through that. He names those three of them were, again, the search for status, for satisfaction, and for self. I was trying to think back before I came to Christ. Probably it was the search for self that would most identify where I was at back then. And it just wasn't leading me anywhere helpful. It was like that whole looking inside yourself to try and find truth, which of course is, you know, at least for me, it changed every week, it seemed like. So it was like a never-ending search.
Yeah. So like there's a question here a little bit that we have to think through, and then I think Trevin helps us think through, is the idea of what is the North Pole for the Christian? What is the different goal of our life that's contrary or even in conflict with what the culture would say is the goal for our life? How would you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, like on page 77, he points out what I find to be true as I talk to people, that many in our society, he says, he's referring to a conversation or something that a lady named Gretchen Rubin wrote. She says, "Is being yourself is like people's greatest commandment, and therefore the greatest failure, or some might even call it sin, would be to sacrifice your own desires or dreams in order to gain someone else's approval or to conform to someone else's view for your life." And that so hits the nail on the head, I think, for what at least for me, the average person I talk to seems to have that mindset. A lot of people, even within the church, they really just have latched onto that. And so this is the whole, well, I can't tell someone else to do with their life. Who am I to judge them? And they're that sort of thing. It all just seems to kind of flow out of that. But then you, and where he goes next is really showing us, you can already start to smell how that is so antithetical to the Christian worldview, to say, no, actually, the greatest thing in life is actually to sacrifice your own desires, to sacrifice your own dreams. But you do that because of Christ. You know, we lay down our lives because he laid down his for us, and then we pursue whatever he wants for our life, which is literally the opposite of what most people would view as the way to happiness.
Grayson, do you think that, this idea of happiness is something that Christians should abandon altogether? Like, really, we should stop saying that the goal of life, even for a Christian, is happiness, and really get on with saying maybe the goal of the Christian life is holiness. What do you think about that kind of distinction?
Yeah, well, I think that the part of the problem is that we kind of look at those as mutually exclusive. So, like, if I want to be happy, well, you know, that doesn't go with holiness. Or if I want to be holy, well, then I can't be also happy. I think that God's greatest and primary goal for our lives is actually to make us holy, is to make us just like Jesus. And by the end of everything, that's what he promises to do for us, is to finish that work that he started in us. But the thing is that as we become more holy, as we go through that sanctifying process, well, we actually become more happy. We become, and even more importantly, we become more joyful, which is, you know, not as temporal. It's not as temporary and fleeting as happiness is. And so the more holy we become, the happier, the more joyful we actually become. And so they end up kind of going in the same place. But I do think that we should absolutely abandon as the church this pursuit of kind of the American dream version of happiness, where it's the comfortable home, the right to freedom, and pursuit of pleasure, and all these sorts of things that go along with that. I think we should abandon that as the church, because that is a warped understanding of what Jesus or God would refer to as happiness for his people.
Yeah, and I think that's where, like, the Blaise Pascal makes the statement that all men seek happiness. It's the pursuit of everyone, from people who go to war, even to people who commit suicide. At the end of the day, we're all seeking happiness. The question is, how do we find that happiness? Where does that lead us in a lot of ways? So I think Trevin is right in saying the compass does point towards north. There is a north for us, a north pole for us. And I think we can even say the goal of that is ultimate happiness. So I think God has intended and wired humanity to be happy, to have lives of joy, to be fulfilled. I think those are things that entail that idea of happiness. The issue is, our compass off? You know, do we have, have we replaced what is a true sense of north? And even the way to get there, with other means and other motives and other ways.
Yeah, and I mean, the frightening thing is the answer is absolutely yes, we have. If you look at page 79, Trevin cites some statistics, and he says that for most Americans, they believe the purpose of life is the enjoyment that comes from looking deep within to find your true self while pursuing whatever brings you happiness. Like, that is what most Americans believe the purpose of life is about. And then the paragraph below that is then where he looks into the statistics on supposed Christians, and his conclusion there is that apparently when it comes to questions about the purpose of life and the pursuit of happiness, Christians look an awful lot like the rest of the world. Our maps aren't standing out.
Yeah.
And like it's like you were saying, like we've been given this true north, but it's like we've somehow messed up our compass and we've got it pointed in the wrong direction. And we might even see that it's still pointing north, but we're like, I don't know, I'm going to go this way.
Yeah. I noticed that a lot of, there was a good, at least a little bit of a dialogue on the Facebook page about that particular quote on page 79 with regard to the church, and several of our readers were like, that makes me mad. That's frustrating that is the case within the church. And yet it is true. I see this as a pastor. I'm sure you do as well, where we have we have people that come to our churches that maybe engage for a little while, and then they check out and say, well, it wasn't meeting my need, or you know, I wasn't ultimately fulfilled. And sometimes I see those people not even serving, not even investing themselves in community or in the life of the church. And so I kind of shake my head or scratch my head and go, you know, you can't, of course you weren't fulfilled. You weren't contributing in any way. You weren't part of the church.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that I find the same thing as I am a pastor too. It's the people that feel the most fulfillment from the church are those that are usually the most involved in the life of the church, and not even just involved, but actually invested in giving themselves away to the body. And those are the ones that actually find that fulfillment coming back from it. But that makes sense according to what, you know, Jesus has told us about his church.
Yeah, yeah. Give us one. Let's just do the little list pop here. Give us like two of your favorite quotes from this chapter as a whole.
All right, let's see. This one from page 78 was really good. He said, "There's an important lesson for us here. You can be courageous yet still be wrong about the world. You can be brave yet perish. You can be a strong and determined person on a path to destruction. Sincerity, as good a quality as that may be, cannot ultimately save you. There is a way that seems right to a person, but in the end, it's the way that leads to death." He's citing Proverbs 14:12 there. I thought that was just super helpful because I talk to people all the time that make those kinds of arguments of like, well, they're a good person. They're, you know, he's a really good guy, seems to have a good head on his shoulders. But like, I know just because of the way they live, I'm like, that's not true like at all. And what he's pointing out is like, hey, those things, you can actually, you can be determined. You can have a lot of good qualities, but still not be pursuing the right north, the right, you know, heading as we've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great quote there for sure. What's another one?
Let's see. I like this part right at the very end on page 87 as he's wrapping up the chapter. And he says, "The truly courageous are those who crucify the self the world tells us to be true to. But thank God we are then raised with Christ to become the person God always intended us to be. The greatest adventure we could imagine leads us to die to ourselves daily, because it is only through putting our old self to death that we taste the reality of resurrection."
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it's just such a contrast to everything that the chapter was telling us about. And also this like this desire within people to kind of stand out, to be authentic, to be something different in this world of everything the same. And he's like, hey, if you want to do that, the truly courageous are the ones over here that are dying to themselves and trying to crucify these desires the world tells us we need to have and pursuing Christ wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I think it's probably been David Platt that I think said this. If I attribute it incorrectly, oh well. But, you know, I've heard him say, if you want to do something really radical in the world, like pick up and read your Bible every day. Like that's just, that's so different. And so that quote there kind of makes me think that those who are truly courageous are crucifying the self to the world. And that's really a true mark of courage for sure.
Yeah. What about you? Did you have a couple of quotes that stood out?
Well, one of the first quotes that I really loved in this chapter, when Trevin brought it in, isn't from Trevin himself, but it set up, I think, what will be one of the next quotes. It's on page 82. It's a quote from Augustine. "You've made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find themselves in you." I mean, that just really, to me, sums up the essence of this chapter, that we do long for desire. And so then again on chapter 84, he says, or on page 84, he says, "The longing to have the desires of your heart is right, but the lie is that your heart can tell you exactly what those desires are. Instead, we are to obey the words of the psalmist, 'Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart.' Delight in God, and your desires will match his." And note the command, not to find yourself, but delight yourself. Note also the object, we are to find joy not in things, but in the Lord. That was really helpful in resetting to me about my heart, not to find my happiness in success or status or myself, but delight in the Lord. Have my heart pointed to him. That North Pole imagery really struck in deeply there.
It also pointed out that pursuit of happiness in the correct way, where it's like, the more we pursue His will, the more delight we have. Then we can actually find that delighting in ourself that is true to who He's called us to be.
Yeah, yeah. So that really, really hit me. And then at the end of the chapter, he asks a question, what is our North Pole? To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. The Christian's hope is for our greatest desire to meet our greatest delight. That's what sets us out on our adventure. I love that imagery there of like, this is a journey or an adventure for us. And I can take that home and think through day to day. How am I in the pursuit of Christ? How am I in the journey of knowing Him and being found in Him? And so whatever that will entail or mean, I that just really helped me kind of think in a manner of like putting Christ at the as the goal of my life again, which I really loved.
Yeah, absolutely. That one's great.
So we have this chapter 3 kind of, and Trevin said it, you know, last week. This kind of sets up in a broader setting. He's punched us in the gut on our phone. he's really tackled us hard when it comes to Hollywood and our entertainment. Now he kind of opens up the dialogue more generally with regard to the pursuit of happiness. But it takes us to chapter 4 where he again clobbers us with this idea of consumerism. And chapter 4 is all about the title is Shopping for Happiness. What's your takeaway there? Kind of let's talk about chapter 4 for just a little bit.
Yeah, this subject is something that I've thought a lot about, read a lot about over the last, I don't know, 3 to 4 years. And so it really resonated with me personally just because of my own journey and the things I've thought about. If you go to page 93, I have a lot of these same, like I've thought a lot of these same things where he says, I wonder if people like in the future as they're digging through our garbage when we're like an archaeological site one day, he said he wonders if they're going to have the same reaction towards us that a lot of people have towards people when they watch that show Hoarders, where it's like, why do they have all this stuff? Like there's obviously something wrong with them to have this much trash, because they're just consuming all this stuff. Like, I don't understand. And you mentioned David Platt earlier. I remember him saying the same thing in a sermon where it's like, you know, I wonder if 200 years from now, the church is going to look back and say, how could they be so blind to all of the stuff that they had? Like we have so much in a world that really, honestly, if you look outside of our tiny little part of the world, like in a world that has so little, how do we have so much and we're okay with that?
Right. Yeah, no, it's a huge question. I was instantly drawn to thinking about the movie WALL-E when the robot there is cleaning up planet Earth, you know, like, oh man, that could be so much of how we're viewed down the road. Wow.
Yeah, that's a great imagery. I love that movie.
So chapter 4, just in talking about this idea of shopping, consumerism, there were some really good stories here that he told, I think, in terms of his family. I was captivated as I was reading this, where he started talking about the religion of more now. And, you know, you enter a building that is set apart, a place that's special and unique, and you get closer to the sanctuary. And I'm thinking in my head, you know, what is he describing? And I'm wondering, you know, is he talking about a shopping mall? And then he drops it on us. This is the Apple Store.
Yeah.
I love the Apple Stores. And yet how right
now
that
you
is.
Know why.
Yeah, exactly. It's wow. A temple there, in so many ways. They're not just selling products, but they're making promises, something that he sees. Why do you think this accumulation of stuff is so seductive to us?
I think it's so seductive because of it's kind of the air we breathe. And I think that's kind of what he's talking about is that this stuff is so all encompassing in our culture, particularly here in America, that we just don't even see it. And that becomes more clear in the story he tells later in the chapter, which we'll get to in a minute, about his sister and her husband that lost their house, where they were Christ followers and they didn't even really see how they had bought into this this life lie where everything has to be better, everything has to be more, I have to be progressing up the ladder in order to be happy. They didn't really realize that, and it was because it was so again just enveloping to them. He says on page 100 here, he says, the lie in this story is that accumulation is the goal of life, and that it is a good and noble thing for our financial aspirations to be the primary guide for our actions and choices. And that really, I mean, again, is that, that's the American dream, right? And that's actually what he's talking about right above it. That American dream is the idea that anyone who works hard should be able to find comfort and success. And the dream becomes the narrative that then shapes our choices. And so we tell our life stories in ways that correspond to its terms. And then whether we're moving forward or stepping back depends on our, you know, progress according to those goals. I thought, as soon as you, this reminded me of the Romanian, the communist Romania example in the beginning of the book, where if I can tell a story that's powerful enough for you to recast your own story in that image, well, then I've really got you. And that's really the point that we all find ourselves at with this shopping for happiness, the accumulation of stuff. I think that's where we are right now.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And that's where, you know, we're just, I think we're almost, well, not almost, we're blind to this in so many ways in our society. Like it's just normal, you know? And I, you know, I'll be the first one to confess my own, guilt and, struggle with this, but, you know, again, Apple, you know, announces here's the new iPhone 10, and like my heart says, oh, hey, this one I have, you know, it's no good anymore. You know, it's 2 years old. It's dated. Get rid of it. You know, and yet, is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's how powerful the lie is, because as soon as you're even like when you have that moment, you're calling out the lie by saying, well, they must have lied to me the last time because this one's now, they're saying this one's the best one ever. You know, they kind of always do that. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, even though I kind of, the veil has been lifted a little bit, it's like, I still believe it. It has my heart so much that I'm like, ah, whatever. I'm still going to go for the new one. Even though this one, you know, is still, it has more processing power than all the computers combined in like 1980 or whatever the stat is.
Right. You know, and let's be clear here. It's not, at least I think in many ways, it's not so much the stuff that we have that's the issue. It's as Trevin points out, it's the gravitational pull of the stuff. It's where our hearts are headed that really is the trouble for us in many ways. Right?
Yeah. It's and he does point that out, like you're saying. The main problem is that we're attaching our life's meaning and our pursuit of happiness to the accumulation of more stuff, or to the kind of progressing down the, you know, career ladder, or progressing up the career ladder, or whatever the case is. But it's the meaning that we're staking in it that actually is more of the problem than the stuff itself. I mean, yeah, we can have too much stuff, and Jesus has a lot to say about that. But when it comes to the meaning that we're attaching to it, I think that's really the lie that he's trying to point out here.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I want to talk with him more, and we'll do this when we get a chance to converse with him next. I want to talk with him a little bit about this idea. He drops it in, and this would be one of my top quotes from this chapter, in the section entitled "From Holy Days to Shopping Days." It starts at page 97. He makes this statement: when society adopts the myth that the primary purpose of life is to accumulate more stuff, even time gets reconfigured to help people consume more and better. This is what the world looks like when everything is geared toward the myths of consumerism. Out with the saints, in with the shoppers. Love that line. But what I want to push in on him a little bit is, and not to disagree with him at all, because I think he's right on, but how does the American church reconfigure time in a way that tells a different story?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is one of the places where a more liturgical church is actually has an advantage. Someone that can enter into the seasonal, the historic kind of traditional Christian mm-hmm. calendar of seasons of Lent, seasons of Advent. You know, these things they're still common, I know, in a lot of churches, but there are also a whole lot of churches where that stuff's just never even really talked about. But those things are designed to bring us into the Christian story. Mm-hmm. And I think that those things they're a counter, it's that counter formation, you know, where we say, no, we have a better story to tell, and this is how we're going to enter into it for the next 40 days or, you know, the Advent season or whatever that time is. But I really do think that that's one of the powerful ways that that we have to tell our story in a powerful way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a different, you know, not only are we using the analogy of the map in terms of finding our North Pole and what makes us happy, but the idea of a timepiece that's different and distinct from the world's timepiece or the calendar of that. I think that's a good practice that we should talk about and discuss. And I look forward to talking with Trevin about that too next week. What was one or two of the top quotes from you from this chapter?
I like this one from page 105. The first sentence I'll read is him kind of summarizing what Jesus said about something, and then it's his own thought. So he says, "No, he said, Jesus said, put your treasure where your heart should be, and there your heart will follow." Then Trevin says, "In other words, you should recognize that earthly possessions have a gravitational pull, so you ought to be strategic in putting them where you want your heart to follow." And that's just so, and again, he's really just paraphrasing what Jesus has already said. It's like, no, man, I was just reading this morning. You guys are anxious about what you're going to eat, about what you're going to drink, about what you're going to wear. Like, stop worrying about those things. God knows that you need them, and he's going to provide them for you. Look, he clothes the flowers more beautiful than any of those. You know, he cares about all the birds in the sky. Don't you think he cares a lot more about you, who he values so much more? And then he says, the opposite of that is like, invest your money somewhere where nothing can happen to it. Put your money into things that matter, that have an eternal value. Invest your money in my storehouses. That way, when you get up to heaven, well, now you get this huge inheritance, and it's not going to fade away. It's not going to spoil. It's that whole idea. And I just, you can probably tell just the way I'm talking about it. That's very important language that Jesus uses to me personally. And so I love the way that Trevin played off of that.
Yeah, that's a great quote. Really an excellent thought. And so talk about that just for a second. You know, how do you put your possessions where you want your heart to follow them? What does that look like in a day-to-day life?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of this comes down to where do you invest your money? Where do you give your money? Where do you give your time even? So in a very basic sense, this is kind of the Christian idea of tithing, of giving 10% of your income to your local church, and then kind of increasing your giving from there. And so I know within my own life, I started there, was blessed, and God gave me the grace to know that I should do that from the time I got my first job. And so I've done that ever since then. And just that even baseline level of giving, I've just seen him bless us in so many ways because of that. And that's not even really what it's about, but it's that whole, there is that principle where he says, like, hey, you know, as you trust me, you'll find that I can be trusted. And especially as we do that with our money, because that's the hardest thing, I think, one of the hardest things for most people to let go of. But then beyond the tithing example, it would be giving your money away to the causes of Christ around the world, whether that's church planting movements in India or China or something like that, or widow and orphan care around the world, money to help rescue, you know, girls from sex trafficking in the Philippines, or like whatever the example is, something that invests your money into causes that Jesus cares about. To me, it seems like that's how you actually invest that treasure in heaven. And it's basically when you, the way he talks about it is like, as you give it away for those kinds of things, not as you invest it in the sense that you're looking for a return, but as you just give it away joyfully to these causes of Christ around the world, that is how you store up treasures for yourself in heaven.
Yeah, yeah. He does say on page 111, generous giving is another practical way of reorienting your heart. It may not come naturally to us, at least not at first, but when we are truly gripped by the gospel that Christ gave up heavenly riches and for our sakes became poor, how can we not be filled with generosity towards others? The regular habit of cheerful and consistent giving will loosen the grip of stuff, the grip our stuff has on our hearts. Really good. Yeah, really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, the only other two things I would point out, one, this one's related to giving, but giving in secret, giving out of love for Jesus and his causes, and never like making a pact with yourself, like, I'm never going to tell another person about this, because doing it in that anonymity takes away any glory that you might possibly get from it and just gives it all to him. and to his cause, which is a good exercise for us in the day of social media. The other one I would say is, and this is a little more of not necessarily money, but about how we use our resources, is being open to opening your home to people that are, you know, homeless or people that need a place to stay, someone in your body, your church family that, you know, kind is down and out or whatever, yeah. Just needs a time to get back on their feet. But just being open to these kind of opening the fortress that we sometimes create with our homes in America today. But that, to me, is one of the things that stood out to me as I was reading through the chapter.
Yeah, that's really the biblical idea of hospitality, of loving strangers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And caring for them. So great, great. Yeah, this is where the rubber really meets the road for us in terms of what faithfulness looks like. And I do appreciate this at the end of the chapter. You know, Trevin is careful not to be not to be legalistic in terms of what he's calling us to, and at the same time, not to be a conformer either toward the culture of this world. But he does say, this is the last sentence of chapter 4, faithfulness will look different from person to person, from church to church. But we are called to be good stewards who sacrifice for the king out of gospel-soaked, generous hearts. And so I love that. You know, it's really kind of a, it's going to look different for a lot of us in many different ways. The calling, though, isn't for us to meet a percentage or a line. The calling is us for is for us to demonstrate a better reality in the gospel than what we experience here in this world.
Yeah, I think I also read this morning that the in Luke's gospel, where the widow puts in two, you know, they equate it to pennies, really. Then all the other guys are giving away a bunch of money. And Jesus is like, I'm telling you the truth here. She's giving away way more than they are, because she's giving out of her poverty, where they're giving out of their riches or their excess. And he's telling us a very important principle. It's like, when you give generously and when you give sacrificially, that is the kind of giving that he truly blesses, and that those are the things that are really giving to the causes of Christ.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's good. That's good. Well, Grayson, I think we've kind of hit the main points on chapter 3 and 4, and kind of moved along well in this conversation. Anything else you want to add before we sign off today?
No, I think that's it for these chapters.
Good deal. Well, next week we'll pick up chapter 5, which is entitled "Never at Home in the City of Man." That'll be fun. Again, more challenge for us. I hope the book club and the reading has been beneficial to you and your spiritual development and formation. Again, we want to encourage you to send in any questions for Trevin, as we'll be recording another exclusive interview with him next week to kind of drop your questions in on him and maybe probe in a little bit deeper on some of these things that we've discovered as we've gone along. So we look forward to that next week. Feel free to chat and have more conversation. Share with us your favorite quotes on our Facebook page. And we are so grateful to have you as partners with us with the GCD Book Club. So once again, we thank you for listening, and we appreciate so much your feedback and your partnership with us in this. We hope that you have a great week for Grayson and for myself. Take care. And until next time, we hope you enjoy reading.